Hi, I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is a Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Wow. Well, how much reality can you handle today?
Not this much.
Not this much.
This is too much.
Today, we're going to talk about Flannery O'Connor's short story collection called Everything That Rises Must Converge. This is episode 99. Yeah. So why not talk Flannery O'Connor? She's like the patron saint of
That's
our
right.
podcast. Yeah.
That's right.
Right. And we talked about a previous collection of hers, A Good Man is Hard to Find.
I almost can't even say that anymore. I just think Good Story is hard
good
to
story,
find.
Good story, yeah. That was episode number 32 for those who are interested.
Huh.
Yeah.
That was a long time ago.
It was a long time ago. So I thought, man, we need to talk about some more of her.
That's a good choice because you said Flannery O'Connor. My stomach sank because her stories can be so tough.
They are a little bit brutal.
But I listened to just a touch. But I listened to the audiobook, and I don't know if it was this collection or the audio of it, but wow. I loved these stories,
yeah,
even though they were kind of brutal, some of them.
right. I listened to the last three.
It just kind of washed over me. Yeah.
Yeah. You know who's a great narrator is, And now his name just slipped away.
Bronson Pinchot.
That's him. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the audio collection has four different people, two women and two men, although I think Bronson Pinchot did most of the ones that had a man reading them. I could be wrong. I didn't listen to the last two stories, but they were all excellent.
They were. They really were. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the stories included here is, or are, Everything That Rises Must Converge, title story, Green Leaf, A View of the Woods, The Enduring Chill, The Comforts of Home, The Lame Shall Enter First, Revelation, Parker's Back, and Judgment Day, leading up the end.
we're
falling
at
the end. Last and certainly last, Judgment
Day.
Yep.
Yeah, and you know what's funny? I really surprised myself, as I said, by liking them. I liked all of them except The Comforts of Home, Parker's Back, and Judgment Day.
Mm-hmm.
Those three didn't really strike me so much.
Yeah, I guess I would, I can't disagree with that. I would say those are my least favorites of the eight. Mm-hmm. Or nine.
Yep. They all had something to offer. You could see it, but the
they
other
did.
Ones just grabbed me.
Right. There's just something about her stories. You know, I don't know that I always completely understand them, but when I read them, there's clearly something deep going on. And when I leave one of her stories, you know, that's not the end. You know, I can't read story. I have to go story. Okay. Now, what does this mean? You know, I just can't continue on. The best thing is to read one a day or something like that and contemplate and think about it a little bit. Not that that always helps. it spurs a lot of thought in me.
Right.
I don't know that I always understand what she means or what she's trying to say.
Yeah, I usually only understand it on the broadest level. So anybody listening who just loves her stuff, just feel free to chime in later because in the comments, because I'm not used to reading stories like this. I mean, it's like watching In Bruges.
Yeah, you know, and I was thinking the same thing. Not specifically about In Bruges, but, you know, a lot of these TV shows now, like Fargo, you know, Fargo comes to mind. All of those, the movies by those guys who did Fargo, Coen Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
All the movies by them. It's like they were inspired by her. You know, you can just feel that she has influenced them somehow because the shocking violence, You know, her stories are not all about violence, but there's often a very shocking moment that just occurs. And in the movies, you know, people like the Coen brothers, they show those things, graphically.
McDonagh brother, if that's I can't remember if that's how you say it. Mm. They did in Bruges, and then one did in Bruges, the other one did Calvary.
Yeah, okay.
They do have those violent, grotesque moments, but they are there to underline something. Or as Flannery O'Connor said, she put them in to wake you up.
Yeah.
You know, she said, I'm not preaching to the people who are already in good shape. Uh-huh. It's kind of, she makes me think of the prophets, where they don't come to make you comfortable. They come to shake you up and make you see the truth, even when you don't want to see it. And that's why, you know, poor Jeremiah gets stuffed down a well head first. Mm-hmm. And that kind of thing, because no one wants to hear what he has to say.
Yeah.
It's not what I want to do or hear. So this is, if you read these, even on the most superficial level, and think about them, as you say, they kind of sink in. That's what they're doing to you, because you can see yourself in some of this. I don't like to think about, in Everything That Rises Must Converge, Julian, the unpleasant, determined to be liberal and progressive son. I see something of myself in that.
Yeah, no question. I think if we didn't see ourselves in these characters, they would just be cartoons.
Right.
I mean, they're not something that would make any difference to us, but it's because we see that, and then this shocking thing occurs. It's almost as if it goes all the way down, and then you're just like, oh my goodness, you know? And that's why it's almost like a recovery time after I read a story like that, because I have to figure out what it means and file it. You know, it's like, you know, I've got to deal with this. It's almost, it's an experience that I have to deal with. It's not something that I just move on, you know, and just pretend it didn't happen. If, you know, I think that it's just fantastic in that way. And you can only take so much of it. And then upon contemplation, it becomes extremely meaningful. So it rewards the contemplation. It's not like you think about it and you just, you know, it's not worthwhile. It is extremely worthwhile.
Right.
So everything I've read by Flannery O'Connor so far has been wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Agreed.
Yes. So I brought something. This is a New Yorker magazine from September of 2013 that I bought because I think it was Father Martin on Twitter said, hey, check out the New Yorker magazine. Flannery O'Connor's in it. So I went and looked. You know, I went to the bookstore and they had one. And I just bought it. And I figured I'd read one of these. What these are journal entries from January, it says in 1946 time frame. And she passed away in 64, I believe.
Oh, I don't remember.
Yeah, August 3rd, 1964. She was 39 years old when she passed away.
So young.
Yeah. So she kept a journal, and it says here in the introduction to this article that over a year and a half, she filled this notebook with a series of entries addressed to God. The following excerpts from her journal chart her thoughts on the subject of faith and prayer and her hopes for her fiction. So I'd like to just read one, if that's okay.
Oh, please do.
Okay. She says, there's no date on it. She says, my dear God, how stupid we people are until you give us something. Even in praying, it is you who have to pray in us. I would like to write a beautiful prayer, but I have nothing to do it from. There is a whole sensible world around me that I should not be able to turn to your praise, or that I should be able to turn to your praise, but I cannot do it. Yet at some insipid moment, when I may possibly be thinking of floor wax or pigeon eggs, the opening of a beautiful prayer may come up for my subconscious and lead me to write something exalted. I am not a philosopher, or I could understand these things. If I knew all of myself, dear God, if I could discover everything in me pedantic, egocentric, in any way insincere, what would I be then? But what would I do about those feelings that are now fear, now joy, that lie too deep to be touched by my understanding? I am afraid of insidious hands, O Lord, which grope into the darkness of my soul. Please be my guard against them. Please be the cover at the top of the passage. Am I keeping my faith by laziness, dear God? But that is an idea that would appeal to someone who could only think. That's it.
Wow.
Yeah. Absolutely stunning. And this may be a book. Do you know if it is or not, if they collected them into a book?
Yeah, and this was, when you were talking about it, it was calling up a memory of, I was looking on Amazon, I guess, for a book that I later got from the library, which is, you know, the Library of America will collect works of famous American authors and put them all together.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I'm using the library copy of O'Connor Collected Works, which is really a wonderful book. It's fairly small, considering it's got 1,200 pages or something in it. And it's got all of her stuff, plus some letters and things from The Habit of Being. So it's really easy to read all together. But when I was looking for that, I saw the prayer journal and I thought, oh, somebody took her stuff and pasted it into a prayer journal. And when I started reading about it, it was saying that they had taken this journal that had been found and turned it into a book. And I hadn't stopped to look at any samples, but now that you've read that, I'm definitely going to have to put this on my wish list.
Yeah, this me too. If I can find it, I may have to just get myself a copy. I'm working my way through The Habit of Being now. On your recommendation, I went ahead and I got the book, and I'm just reading it leisurely. Mm-hmm. As it comes up, I'll read a few rather than just reading it straight through. So
that's a good way to do it.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Good.
I just love it, yeah.
Yeah, it's just interesting because at first you don't know her, so you're kind of struggling, but about a third of the way in, suddenly you're just going, oh, I do know her. And it's like you're having a conversation with her, too. So.
And I'm eager to read it, having read so many of her stories now. I think it'll be even more meaningful, because I did poke around in a little bit to look to see what she had to say about the stories that we read. And she mentions them now and then. It's going to be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Before I let this go, there was just one other really short two sentences that I just loved that I'd like to read.
Yeah.
It says, "No one can be an atheist who does not know all things. Only God is an atheist." I guess three sentences. "The devil is the greatest believer, and he has his reasons." And that is a journal entry, and complete journal entry. I love it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, I could just
hope that makes
sit around
the quote
and
journal.
Think about that for a while,
that's
right?
That's going to make the quote journal.
My gosh.
I love it.
It's
it is,
her own
it is
quote
really
journal.
True, too. I mean,
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I think I read that about atheism somewhere just recently, and I'm thinking, oh, had they read Flannery O'Connor? Or
nice. So, yeah, I think the way we should proceed with this discussion, I think that I would just recommend that people read these stories before listening to us. We're just, it's not worth talking about without getting into it deeply. Now what we decided to do, we can't talk about nine stories. So what we decided to do is we're going to talk about the title story, Everything That Rises Must Converge. And then I picked a story to talk about called The Lame Shall Enter First, and Julie selected a story for us to talk about called Revelation. So that's why we'll move forward from here. Otherwise, we'll be here for a very long time, and we'll be weeping by...
We may anyway. I liked what you said. You wrote me an email at one point, and you said, I'm almost done. I've got just a few more, then I'm going to curl up in a ball on the floor and cry.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, goodness. Well, I have to say, though, again, I don't know if it's the audio or skill or just my frame of mind, because just to mention a story that we're not going to talk about, when I got done with The View from the Woods, or The View of the Woods, whatever it's called.
Yeah, The View of the Woods. Yeah.
A View of the Woods, where the grandfather murders his granddaughter and then dies himself.
Good heavens.
Well, but the thing was, is by the time I got to that point, I was like, oh, it's like they're the same person. It's opposite sides of the same person. I was so into it that that didn't even bother me.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And I was going, oh, no, I've crossed some terrible threshold here. What's wrong with me?
So, and then that is something, you know, we touched on it earlier, but, you know, about violence, you know, violence in movies, you know, we watch a Quentin Tarantino movie or something. I don't really know if he's got points that he's making or not, but there comes a point at which, you know, when you watch some movies like the Coen brothers, where the violence can wash over you because maybe you're seeing why it's being done or something like that. But that's a really interesting point that you make. Because I think we're going through some of that now. It's just that people, I don't know that a lot of people are reading Flannery O'Connor, but a lot of them are certainly watching the Coen brothers or Quentin Tarantino.
Oh, yeah. And that's, for me, I tend to avoid those. And in fact, just watched Gone Baby Gone again recently and had my own revelation about that movie. Sometime we'll have to watch it. But it was very violent, very profane, but so profoundly meaningful underneath all of it that I have been thinking about it for at least a week.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what these stories do, you know, just on a different level. I haven't tried one of her novels, and I'm not sure if I can make it through one without cracking. But I will be trying sometime, which is why I was looking up the Library of America books. I thought, well, if I'm going to do this, I might as well just see if the books are available used.
Yeah.
You know.
I've got an audio – well, she's only written two novels, right?
Right.
Wise Blood and The Violent Bear It Away. So she put the word violent right in the title.
Yeah.
Just as a warning.
Wise Blood was her first. I know. Yeah.
She wrote that in 1952, it says, and I've got the audio version of that read by Bronson Pinchot.
Oh.
Someday I will listen.
Yeah, when we're feeling very brave and have had a lot of light sitcoms to watch.
Right, right.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, so should we dive
in? Yeah, let's do dive in. Let's do dive in. Everything That Rises Must Converge is the title story. Go ahead.
We don't need to summarize it since you said for people to read.
Well, we ought to summarize it just really quick. I think, you know, some people would prefer to listen and not read. So just briefly, it's Julian is the name of, what would you say? He's like
a protagonist.
He's fairly young. He's out of college, I think.
Living at home.
Yeah, fairly young guy, but he's still living at home with his mom. And his mom is on her way to a exercise class, right? Reducing class or something like that.
Yes.
They're on their way. And to get there, they have to ride the bus.
Mm-hmm.
And to ride the bus means that they have to mix with black people from the same town. And her mom is like old school and has certain ways that she likes to interact with them. And he, being a recent college graduate, has kind of it horrifies him. Am I doing this justice?
Yeah, I think the point that you get from it is integration is fairly new.
Yes.
You know, they're not really used to it. So she's trying to, in a sense, she's trying to adjust because she'll kind of stop herself. And then she'll go, I don't care. This is how it is, you know. And she's not really saying anything that in and of itself is bad if you understand the kind of lady she is, which is made really clear by the how she talks about the new hat she has and that. So she's just, she's an old Southern lady and having trouble adjusting to that. Her son is very angry and he uses his liberal progressive mindset to constantly run little dialogues in his head.
Right.
Of scenarios that I know what I'll do. I'll bring home somebody to dinner. Then what'll she do? Oh, I know what I'll do. I'll bring home a black woman and say she'll be my wife. You know, and so, and then he'll run the
Something that happens in her stories so often is that you'll have a character that thinks quite a bit of him or herself. And yet through his or her actions is doing obvious things that are a complete opposite of what he thinks is his or her best trait. Right. So
yeah.
He thinks, you know, I'm the enlightened one here and I'm wonderful, but yet he just can't help just poking her and trying to, you know, he despises his situation. I think,
yeah.
Something that I got out of it that, he didn't like having to live at home. And though she was giving him all of this stuff, he still had to feel bad about her. Even though he thinks so much of himself that, well, the reasons that I don't like her is because of these reasons. But yet the story really is that, like you said, it's about racism, I think.
In a way, but it's about how people, I think, well, I guess we should finish summarizing, but I mm-hmm. think it's about how racism becomes a different mirror of what you really are, because there's a racist black lady in this, just like yeah. he's racist. And they both feel, I don't want to say enlightened, set free or something from those old conventions.
Yeah.
Both act the exact wrong way.
Yeah. Did you happen to look up this in her Habit of Being book?
No.
Okay. Because I remember reading one of her letters where she was explaining to a friend that she was really saying a pox on both their houses,
mm-hmm.
you know, because everybody, oh, wow. like you said, it was new. She was trying to, everybody's trying to figure out how to live in this new world. Right.
Yeah.
But she was saying, well, both sides have work to do. It isn't yeah. just one side.
I feel very smart now.
Yeah,
thank you,
yeah.
Scott.
So, but that's the way she said it. She said a pox on both their houses.
Well, yeah, because what happens basically is they get on the bus and the mother is engaging in conversation. There are no black people on there. So the mother's, you know, talking about, well, aren't we lucky that none of them are here? Well, then, of course, a black man gets on and sits opposite her. And the son, to show his solidarity, goes and sits next to the black guy and asks him for matches. And the guy's just reading a paper. Mm-hmm. It's surrounding him. He's not paying attention to anyone. And he asks for matches, and the guy gives him some. And then he's like, oh, no smoking. So he feels stupid because he was doing it to prove a point. So he has to give him back. And the guy's like, you idiot, takes him back. I mean, he doesn't say anything. He's just like, what? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens is a black lady gets on who has a little boy named Carver. And the black lady has on the exact same hat as the mother. And the son is like, ha, this'll show her. And what happens is the mother looks and starts to get really, you can't tell if she's embarrassed or upset. Her face gets really red.
Yeah, right.
But what happens is she then sees the humor in the situation and she just starts to smile. And that infuriates the son because he wants her to understand how low she is. And instead she's not. I mean,
yeah,
she's being human. She's relating to that lady in her hat as a human being.
Yes, yes.
And then the little boy, she loves little children, and she and the little boy, Carver, keep, you know, talking to each other and giggling and playing peekaboo. This infuriates both the son, Julian, mm-hmm. and the little boy's mother. They don't want them being friendly at all. And so finally what happens is they get off the bus at the same stop, and the mother, Julian's horrified because he knows his mother always gives any little kid a nickel. So she's looking, all she has is a penny. So she called, little boy, here's a penny. And at that, the black woman's rage comes out and she just wails the mother with her red pocketbook. And the mother falls down, Julian's mother, who I don't know if you noticed, she doesn't even have a name. She's just Julian's mother. And at the beginning, the reason she was having to go to the reducing class is because she's in danger of having a stroke. Well, she has a stroke. And she's dying, lying there dying. And Julian at that point goes, oh, my gosh, everything he was thinking about goes away. And he's like, mama, don't leave me. And that's the end of the story.
Yeah, yeah.
Love it.
Oh, shoot. Yeah. As do I. It's an affecting story.
Well, the point's made so often, starting at the beginning, of how innocent the mother is, that even though she has what are considered improper attitudes, she was raised that way. She didn't know they were improper. And she's at an age where, you know, we've all known people like this. I think it's hard for them to shift.
Yeah, yeah.
But yet when she encounters them face to face, you know, she realizes it's funny that she and the lady have the same hat. She's playing with the little boy. And this makes me think of Tom's, well, my grandparents, you know, they had these attitudes that would pop out sometimes, but they were never mean to anybody face to face. Tom's father, really, you know, he fought in World War II. He did not like the Japanese, but as a businessman, he had to deal with them all the time, and he loved all the people face to face that he dealt with. And so it's interesting that Flannery picks that as something I can recognize from a generation before mine, or I guess, yeah, a generation before mine, where you kind of just made allowances. You didn't like it, but you didn't react the way Julian did unless you had something internal of your own going on, because you just went, they can't really help it. You know, they're not trying to be ugly. In fact, they're trying to be good. They're just not able to pull it off the way society would like to see it, you know?
Right. And I got the impression that Julian was horrified by her offering this kid a penny, not because he didn't want him to be friendly.
Right.
But because he thought that she was taking a position of like being superior to this lady and saying, you know, I'm going to give you money.
Oh, no, no. I felt it was because he knew what the mother was going to do.
Okay. But why would the mother have reacted the way she did?
Because she saw it as condescending.
Right. Okay. So I think we're saying the same thing then. You know,
not his mother though,
right?
Being condescending, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I thought. Yeah, I thought Julian. Mother. Yeah, Julian thought his mother was being condescending, and that was going to send the other woman through the roof.
No, I felt like Julian was afraid that the black lady was. I mean, he knew how it was going to look, but when the lady exploded. I mean, he couldn't even react. He shut his eyes. I'm like, you're the worst son in the world. But and he does yell at her. But I think
yells at her before or as she's getting ready to do it. Because
right,
and she's and like, no, don't do it.
But
yeah,
I felt like the reason he was yelling at her was because he was finally justified in saying some of the things he'd been thinking.
Mm-hmm.
But I also felt like he'd seen how that black mother reacted, and he knew how it was going to look. And that's why he was trying to take the pocketbook away and tell her not to do it also.
Sure. Okay.
Maybe I was giving him more credit than we see in the story.
No, I don't know. I think we're saying fairly close to the same
thing. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So there was a line here when Julian was sitting across from his mom, and the mother of the child sat next to him, and the child sat next to his mom.
Mm-hmm.
He said, Julian saw that it was because she and the woman had, in a sense, swapped sons.
Yeah.
Though his mother would not realize the symbolic significance of this, she would feel it. His amusement showed plainly on his face. And that's a really common way, I think, that she writes. Because you have somebody, but she's always digging into their inner thoughts. So you know what's going on inside at least one of the characters.
Well, and that's the point, too, where he realizes that they're wearing the identical hat, and it says his face was suddenly lit with joy. He could not believe that fate had thrust upon his mother such a lesson. Fate is capitalized. He gave a loud chuckle so she would look at him and see what he saw. She turned her eyes on him slowly. The blue in them seemed to have turned a bruised purple. For a moment, he had an uncomfortable sense of her innocence, but it lasted only a second before principle rescued him. Justice entitled him to laugh. His grin hardened as it said to her, as plainly as if he were saying aloud, "Your punishment exactly fits your pettiness. This should teach you a permanent lesson." And what happens instead, of course, is she sees the humor and she smiles.
Yeah.
And what happens is it's turned back on him. His punishment is because he's so petty. The permanent lesson is that his mother and that little boy are the truly innocent ones who could get along in that new world.
Mm-hmm.
But these two other people won't let them, and so his mother dies because of it, and he's left alone.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just so well written.
Oh, it is. Yeah. Then slightly later, just like you said, when she smiled, I think he likes me, Julian's mother said and smiled at the woman. It was the smile she used when she was being particularly gracious to an inferior. Yeah. Julian saw everything lost. So it's still Julian's point of view. The lesson had rolled off her like rain on a roof.
And of course, we don't know if she ever got a lesson at all.
Yeah, yeah.
All she knows is her son's being annoying because she, in fact, at one point he's thinking something and not responding the way she thinks. And she's nattering on about this hat and it was expensive and she should have used the money to pay a bill.
Mm-hmm.
And so it says she looked at him and misunderstood and said, oh, I'll go back and take the hat off and I'll send it back. And it wasn't what he was thinking at all. So they just don't even understand each other.
Yeah. So, wow, racism bad.
Yeah, but also, we're, none of us are immune.
Yeah, absolutely not. Absolutely not. What we think about each other.
Yeah, Julian is so busy thinking about her, he cannot see himself.
Right, exactly. And I think she makes that point a lot.
Right.
Yeah. It's like, you know, they're caught up. People are caught up in what you're doing and, you know, you're doing the right thing. Well, why are you doing the right thing? Is that a selfish thing that you're doing? You know, you're doing what you think is right. And sometimes it blinds you to everything else. You know, that happens a lot to her characters.
Yeah. And that the name of this, Everything That Rises Must Converge, is from, oh gosh, I think I wrote to you about
it. I've actually got it right here.
Oh, okay. Good.
Yeah, I have this little book on Flannery O'Connor, just a couple of things. But it says here that there is a Jesuit priest named Pierre Teilhard de Jardin, whose works Flannery O'Connor had been reading at least since early 1961. It says they're highly relevant. So that's where the title, Everything That Rises Must Converge, comes from.
Yeah.
Let's see. It says here, Teilhard's The Phenomenon of Man expresses his belief in an evolutionary process towards an ultimate, call it an omega point. So, let's see. It says it better here. The title, Everything That Rises Must Converge, refers to a work by the French philosopher Pierre Teilhard de Jardin, who is a Jesuit. It says, remain true. This is a quote from his book. Remain true to yourself, but move ever upward toward greater consciousness and greater love. At the summit, you will find yourselves united with all those who, from every direction, have made the same ascent. For everything that rises must converge.
We might have the same book. I'm not sure, because I found that quote. And then this one says, thematically, most of the 9 stories in the collection have characters that are in evolution towards some supreme consciousness. But their full arrival at the omega point is beyond the end of the story. Rather, the story suggests a projection toward that eventual arrival. Now, even that short quote is a bit beyond me. I'm just going to say it. However, what I could see from each of the stories and what that pointed out to me was each of the characters, and especially you see it in this story, hits a moment of great crisis. And that crisis is often generated through one of these violent or extreme moments in their lives. And that, to me, I hope I never have such extreme moments as these characters, but they're so true. I mean, that's the times when you really see a supreme truth is often after you've been jolted like that. You know,
exactly,
and it allows you to bounce. You're seeing how far down you've gone or how far you have left to go, maybe. And that's when you get that moment of enlightenment that shows you, man, exactly who you are, and it can be in a good or a bad way, but it's usually very humbling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so. I agree with that. You know, as far as, you know, this Omega Point thing, you know, I just felt that, you know, like in this story, for example, you know, the evolution past racism, which, you know, someday we'll achieve, is I think that this is just a snapshot of here's the difficulty in the evolution. You know, the older person is having more trouble than the younger person, but then the younger person feels superior, which causes its own tension. I mean, it's complicated, right? So it's like we're all on this path, wherever this Omega Point might be or whatever we want to call it. I agree that we're all on some kind of an evolutionary path. As humanity, how I was thinking of it, as an entire group of humanity, not just Julian and his mom and the kid and his mom. It was like humanity.
I think the way the Omega Point was, you know, he may be talking about human evolution, but it says, in a complicated exegesis, Teilhard suggests that this human evolution, which brings the outside universal world in tandem with the inside personal world, finds its convergence in Christ. Teilhard believes that no human remains static and that to be human is to be continually evolving toward a point that is simultaneously autonomous, actual, irreversible, and transcendent. And so it says, my book says she admitted she didn't understand everything he was saying, but it stimulated her imagination. And especially the fact, I think, that he was talking, evidently, from what I understand, very little, about not only human evolution, but each person has to go through this too. And on that level, as a Catholic, I really understand that, because we all have to, whether you call it evolution, but we all have to develop somehow to the point where we are seeing more with Christ's eyes, following more in his footsteps, which means caring and serving other people in a way that thinks about them first and not us. And when you think about that, which is the only way I can translate that, since I have, as I said, limited understanding, the mother, Julian's mother, is much closer to that. Because even though she says the wrong things and she kind of has the politically incorrect attitudes, she personally is doing that. She's treating that little boy as a regular person. She's seeing the humor in that lady's hat. She's, you know, whereas Julian espouses the correct things, but he is absolutely further behind than she is. He uses the man to get matches to show his point. He doesn't care that he's reading a paper and Julian doesn't need matches.
That is an excellent point.
He's using the mother, you know, the fact that the mother sits next to him, so they have the same hat. He's using that. He doesn't care that maybe that lady might be embarrassed or mad. He certainly doesn't care about his mother. She's lying there on the sidewalk having been struck in the face by this infuriated woman, and he's yelling at her.
Mm.
You know, and he's yelling politically correct, stupid, I hope you're happy because you should have been thinking this, you know. He is so far away from it. And that's why when she dies, that's his moment. It says, help, help, he shouted, but his voice was thin, scarcely a thread of sound. The lights drifted farther away the faster he ran, and his feet moved numbly as if they carried him nowhere. The tide of darkness seemed to sweep him back to her, postponing from moment to moment his entry into the world of guilt and sorrow. So he's at that point, the way I saw it was he was almost just floating in, how do I even find myself? Where's my anchor? She's gone. She was the anchor he had, but he was using her so incorrectly as a thing and not a person. He doesn't have anything real to anchor himself with, and he has to try and find his real self at that point.
That's great. Yeah.
I have no idea if that's right, but
I think that's wonderful. I think, I think you nailed it here because, yeah, the piece that I wasn't thinking about was that, you know, he thinks he's ahead of her, but he's not.
Yeah.
And that's the key right there. But the fact that he used that other person and he's actually using the mother too, not his mom, but the other one.
the black mother.
Right.
Yeah, because he is...
They're objects to him and not people.
Right.
And to her, they're people.
Right. And so even though you can say the wrong thing and you might think the wrong way because none of us are perfect, but if you're dealing with somebody person to person and caring about them as a person, the other stuff should be able to fall away. And that's kind of what happened with the mother and the little boy.
Mm.
You know, and the fact that she wouldn't even stop to think about how that other lady would see her. She was just concerned with the little boy.
Mm. Yep.
You know, where all Julian did was think about how people saw him, which I didn't think about till just now.
Well done. I love it.
Oh, thank you.
Yes.
Hey, just let me talk long all enough. Right. Eventually something makes sense, right?
Wow. But that is a wonderful story, isn't it, though? Mm-hmm. You said you liked it, so.
Oh, yeah, I loved it, and... I think that's why maybe I was thinking of In Bruges or some of these other tough movies where not only do you have to talk about them like this, but you have to experience them more than once. So because now you're comfortable with the story, when you reread it maybe in a year or so,
mm-hmm.
what else sinks in?
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Right.
And that's, I think, why you and I struggle with it, because we're just hitting it for the first time.
Yeah, that one actually, that was my second time on that one.
Oh, well then,
but yes,
you're the worst. I have what no can excuse. I say?
I'm horrible. Horrible person.
Jeez, Scott.
I think the point of the story is who wants pie? That's pretty much what I think it is.
I wanted the penny and the red pocketbook.
So nice.
I'm going to take from everyone.
Yeah.
So.
Well, cool.
No, I'm glad you picked it, though. That the whole book. But
yeah.
That was a great story.
It was good. It was good.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So next is The Lame Shall Enter First.
Talk about a tough one.
Yeah. And this one, at least it seems pretty easy to understand. But it was very affecting to me. The story is about this guy named Shepard who has a son, Norton, right?
Yep.
So I'm just sitting here trying. Okay. His shifting
he's
gears.
He's a do-gooder.
Yeah. He's a very much a do-gooder. But the mom is absent, right?
She's dead.
Right. So he's got this 11-year-old son and he's got this certain view of the world where he's like, well, my son should be getting over this. But the opening scene, the son is getting, 11-year-old boy is getting some cake and some peanut butter and he's,
ketchup.
Yeah. And ketchup. That's right. Don't want to forget the ketchup. So, and he's talking to his son about various things and, just gets to a point where, hey, you need to be just getting over this. And, his son starts to cry and, so clearly the poor boy is not over this.
Right.
So Shepard is the father. He is a, he volunteers at some juvenile facility and kind of gets, I say attached, but he wants to help this kid named Rufus Johnson. And he brings Rufus Johnson into the house, if you can imagine.
Well, I think it's important to say this is a reformatory. So this mm-hmm. is, you can just assume these boys are troubled.
Okay.
And probably right. criminally troubled in those days for them to put them in a reformatory. So uh-huh. So this kid's being held up to Norton as, I saw him eating out of a trash can the other day. And the 11-year-old mm-hmm. kid doesn't have any frame of reference for what he's talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Right. So he brings this kid, Rufus Johnson, into this situation with a poor, grieving 11-year-old boy and him just wanting to help. That's what he wants to do. That's his whole focus. I got to help these people. I got to help all people. You know, that's what he keeps yep. thinking in his head. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I think he also feels, this is more of an excuse, but he is continually noticing how selfish his child is.
Yes.
As he says it. Because, I didn't notice this when his mother was alive. I'm thinking, oh, hint number one.
Oh, that's funny.
But he's very selfish. So by bringing this unfortunate boy into his house, he can help him with this his son Norton's selfishness, because he'll have to share.
Exactly right.
Yeah, so I'm reading at this point going, so you hate your kid. You're just a sweet guy.
Yeah, yeah. And again, he thinks he is the best.
Oh, yeah.
That's what he thinks of himself.
Yeah.
He says to himself, again, you know, Flannery O'Connor is in his head for this story. She mm-hmm. says, let's see. Norton, do you have any idea what it means to share? So he's telling him that he wants to bring Rufus into this house mm-hmm. while the boy's eating his chocolate cake. Norton, Shepherd says, do you have any idea what it means to share? A flicker of attention. Some of it is yours, Norton said, talking about the cake. Some of it is his, Shepherd said heavily. It was hopeless. Almost any fault would have been preferable to selfishness. A violent temper, even a tendency to lie. The child turned the ball of ketchup upside down and began thumping the ketchup onto the cake. So that's what he thinks of his son.
And you also, know? I didn't catch that, except mm-hmm. that Rufus does have a violent temper and a tendency to lie.
Exactly right. Yeah, exactly right. And yeah, so Shepherd is saying, you know, what do you call this? A bleeding heart, I guess. He's like, you know, he's out there, he's eating stuff, and, you know, you need to throw some of this in the garbage so he can have something to eat.
Well, and the irony is that he's saying this to his son, who's having cake with peanut butter and ketchup. And I'm thinking, your own son is eating is garbage, essentially. It's stale cake. Because when he's saying he doesn't have cake,
yeah, and it was stale. It was stale cake. Yeah, it's stale. So I got to put some stuff on it.
No one's fixing him breakfast. Hello. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No one's teaching him how to eat breakfast. I don't know how long the mother's been dead.
Mm-hmm.
No one's taking care of this boy either. And you can't see it right in front of you. It's a brilliant doubling technique.
It really is. Yeah. It really is. And that, you know, the point at which, you know, Rufus Johnson, who does come into the house, he does have a violent temper and he does tend to lie, just like you said.
It terrified me at first because I mm-hmm. thought, oh, what's he going to do to Norton? And then the story took a very surprising turn.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
The surprising turn being that Shepherd is an atheist, right? And Rufus Johnson is a Christian.
Yeah, not a very well-informed one, but he's definitely a true believer of whatever it is he believes.
Whatever it is he believes, he's all over it. That's I felt the same way.
Shepherd says, rubbish, we're living in the space age. You're too smart to give me an answer out of the Bible.
Yeah. So, yeah, this is something. Let's see. He says, I'm trying to figure out how far back to go. See, Johnson continued to gaze beyond him. Okay. I want you to make the most of your intelligence, Shepherd said. What's important to you? Let's talk about what's important to you. His eyes dropped involuntarily to the foot. Study it and get your fill, the boy drawled. Shepherd reddened.
He didn't say he's got a club foot.
Right.
Yeah.
The black deformed mass swelled before his eyes. He ignored the remark and the leer the boy was giving him. Rufus, he said, you've got into a lot of senseless trouble, but I think when you understand why you do these things, you'll be less inclined to do them. He smiled. They had so few friends, saw so few pleasant faces, that half his effectiveness came from nothing more than smiling at them. And the way he says that, at them.
Yeah.
You know, there are a lot of things about yourself that I can think I can explain to you, he said. Johnson looked at him stonily. I ain't asked for no explanation, he said. I already know why I do what I do. Well, good, Shepherd said. Suppose you tell me what's made you do the things you've done. A black sheen appeared in the boy's eyes. Satan, he said. He has me in his power. Shepherd looked at him steadily. There was no indication on the boy's face that he had said this to be funny. The line on his thin mouth was set with pride. Shepherd's eyes hardened. He felt a momentary dull despair, as if he were faced with some elemental warping of nature that had happened too long ago to be corrected now. This boy's questions about life had been answered by signs nailed on pine trees. Does Satan have you in his power? Repent or burn in hell, Jesus saves. He would know the Bible with or without reading it. His despair gave way to outrage. Rubbish, he snorted. We're living in the space age. You're too smart to give me an answer like that, just like you said.
Oh, you know, know, when you said that, I could just see driving through a wooded area and there's just signs on the trees.
Yeah, for sure.
And, you know, when you're reading this out loud, I guess it's because I do know the story. I'm sorry I was laughing the whole way through, but her stories can be so funny.
Oh, yeah. No question. You know? Yeah, there are things like that. Yeah. Yeah. Especially, you know, the one we'll talk about next. It's funny. Oh, it's very funny. Yeah. It's comedy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so he's an atheist. He takes in Rufus. He's determined to reform him using all the most modern thinking. And I thought, I was looking at this, maybe this is why I loved this story too. I thought, oh my gosh, we have not really evolved. Sorry, whatever your name is, priest, much past this point, because I still know people who feel like this is how you should deal with most of these situations. And it's hilarious to see this kid who's like, I'll tell you what I do know. I know who I am and I know what I believe and I know you. Hmm. And you're not going to change me.
Yeah, yeah.
It's an immovable force, like she said. And it's it's funny because he brings the kid into his home and then he just, knowing what he knows about him, he just leaves him with his son.
Leaving the 14-year-old with an 11-year-old. Yep.
Yeah. Who's been to the reformatory and who is saying things like Satan possesses me or whatever it is, you know, like, and so, that's when I started worrying because the kid goes all through the house with little Norton trailing him and he's messing with the mother's bedroom. The mother's bedroom has not been touched.
Yeah.
The father, Shepherd, now sleeps in a different room. And so he's like putting her corsets on and laughing at everything and messing around with her stuff. And the kid's outraged. And I thought, oh, no,
yeah, he's
something terrible to him.
He's outraged because he's still grieving. He's like, gosh, you shouldn't be touching her stuff. That's, you know, making me crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that was heart-wrenching. You know, this poor kid, I mean, it was tough to read, like you were saying, because we had read, what, 6 stories before this. So we knew something horrible was going to happen.
We just weren't sure when or how, but yes.
That's right. That's right. And one other thing before we move on, the dad, one of the things, you know, and this is something that, you know, you talk about not evolving past things. He starts to talk to Rufus Johnson every Saturday for the rest of the year, it says. They have a meeting, a conference.
Before he brings him to his house. Yeah.
And he says, so this is how he's trying to reform his kid. After that, he talked to Johnson every Saturday for the rest of the year. He talked at random, the kind of talk the boy would never have heard before. He talked a little above him to give him something to reach for. He roamed from simple psychology and the dodges of the human mind to astronomy and the space capsules that were whirling around the Earth faster than the speed of sound and would soon encircle the stars. Instinctively, he concentrated on the stars. He wanted to give the boy something to reach for besides his neighbor's goods. So instead of God, what he's giving him is science. And again, you know, there should be no conflict between those two things.
Wow, I didn't even pick up on that point.
That's exactly what he's doing, and you know, that's an argument that we're still having.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and the thing that's kind of funny, too, is when you see just how clearly this kid understands him. When he says, I know what I do, what I do.
Mm-hmm.
And he probably doesn't. He's only 14 the way we're thinking, but after he brings him home and they've had dinner or whatever, and he leaves them. He goes off and he leaves Norton and Rufus together. And he says, now you fellows sit here and get acquainted, he said gaily and started toward the door. I'm going to see what Leola has left us for supper. When he was gone, Johnson raised his head and looked at Norton. The child looked back at him bleakly. God, kid, Johnson said in a cracked voice. How do you stand it? His face was stiff with outrage. He thinks he's Jesus Christ.
Yes.
and that whole thing that you were saying about, you know, oh, he talked a little above him. He gave him the kind of talk he'd never hear because only this guy can provide it, right? Yep. Shepherd. Oh,
right.
Man. So well written.
That is right.
He's so infuriating. I know that
he's infuriating all the way throughout because you're just like, what are you doing?
He never changes. No. He's so blind. And In the book I have is called Understanding Flannery O'Connor. And in that book, it mentioned that she didn't think this story worked because she couldn't like Shepard, and she always liked her characters. And I kind of love that even when they're awful in these books, she likes her characters and is fond of them, because it kind of, she's a, as Tolkien would say, right, a sub-creator. This is the universe she's created. And it made me think, yeah, it gave me a little insight into, except for Shepard, even God loves somebody like Rufus Johnson. God, you know, God even loves him. God loves me when I'm awful. God, you know, even when you're doing these awful things, he's still very fond of you, no matter what happens. And I thought it was interesting that she couldn't like Shepard. Of course,
that
is
interesting. Yeah,
because there's a lot of unlikable people, but he's the only atheist that I remember reading about. But I don't think that's why.
Yeah,
I think it's because how he treats his kid. But
right.
She couldn't get in his head somehow.
But. Yeah, I think that's it exactly. He's got all this. It's like everything that was in the 1960s, you know, coming up. Mm-hmm. He was talking about, you know. All these things, you know, replace God in the 20th century. Well, that was up from that Paul Johnson book, Modern Times.
Oh, you
know, the things that, you know, the difficult things from the 20th century. You know, I can't remember exactly how he put it, but that's what he's feeding him with. He's like, you know, I'm not going to talk to you about God at all. In fact, I'm trying to get it out of you. Here's what you replace it with. And it's, no, it's not going to work. It doesn't, it's not satisfying.
And when it becomes really clear how unsatisfying it is when Rufus is hanging out with Norton. And even though what he's saying is kind of this, you know, half understood Christian theology, Norton's clinging to it because he says, well, you know, when I die, I'll go to hell and burn forever because the devil's got me unless I convert. And then I'm not sure if that's exactly quite the right sequence, but basically and the guy Shepard is going, oh, no, you're going to do things like go to the moon. Hell's not real. But Norton's interested. He's like, so after you die, you go somewhere? My mom might be in hell. And Norton's totally Shepard's totally infuriated, thinking, he'd rather have her in hell than nowhere. And I'm thinking, you just don't get it. To disappear like that, that atheist view of then there's nothing, is horrifying.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
void of hope.
Yeah, exactly. And then he's like, oh, no. And then he thinks, well, it would have been easier if I'd have lied to him and just told him he was in heaven and someday he'd see him, but I just couldn't do it. And Shepard says, your mother's spirit lives on in other people. And I'm like, oh, man. And it'll live on in you if you're good and generous like she was. The child's pale eyes hardened in disbelief. Shepard's pity turned to revulsion. The boy would rather she be in hell than nowhere. Do you understand? He said. She doesn't exist. He put his hand on the child's shoulder. That's all I have to give you, he said in a softer, exasperated tone. The truth. And then he goes, Rufus, is that true? Is she there burning up? And he's like, well, was she bad? Well, she believed in Jesus. Oh, well, then she's in heaven. And that's in the sky. Oh. And he just doesn't understand that dynamic.
Right.
He's so divorced from any real shepherd doesn't, you know, any real human understanding of what you need when somebody's gone like that.
Yeah. Yeah. He's not giving the kid anything, just hardness. Mm-mm.
No, he's not giving him love at home.
No. And instead, he's looking at other people, you know, like Rufus. I mean, not only the kid, but the shepherd is too. That's where Shepherd's finding his meaning, is on the shoulders of Rufus Johnson. You know, that he's I've got to help this kid. That's my purpose now. Not his own son.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't until I read this out loud that, you know, it'll live on in you if you're good and generous like she was. And I'm like, oh, is that when he started doing this stuff, Shepard? That's the only meaning he's got too, because he won't let himself believe anything like that when his wife died.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, so he's, you know, the living out of what he's trying to give his kid.
Yeah, and that's how I thought about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And then the end. Which is tough.
Well, because and then Rufus starts stealing, getting accused of stealing.
Yeah.
And he's such a manipulator. But it's Shepherd's chance to show if he what he believes is true. And he's like, oh well, he doesn't say anything when the police are like, so was he here?
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't say anything, and they're going to take Rufus off to jail. And Rufus is like, "You said you'd believe me. You said you really, I could change. I did. It's not true." And he goes to bail him out the next day, and the kid's like, "Nope, never going to believe you again." And so there are a series of break-ins for which he's accused, and finally, by the end, he's been manipulated into, "No, I believe him no matter what."
Mm.
And the kid's done all of them. He finds out later.
Right. Right.
He's been played like a violin.
And then the poor 11-year-old who has been talking to Rufus and these thoughts in his head, which he's been left alone with, comes to his own conclusions.
Yeah, he's been looking for his mom in the telescope.
If heaven's in the sky, Rufus. I'm going to look through this telescope and hopefully I'll find her.
I'm going to be an astronaut because I'm going to go find mom.
Exactly. It's heartbreaking.
Well, yeah, because then this is so well written, though, no matter whether Flannery felt it worked or not, it really worked for me.
It really did work for me, too, because as soon as he said that, I was like, oh, no, go find your kid.
Oh, yeah, there was foreshadowing all the way, but when he ties himself up with a rope earlier and everything, but...
Mm-hmm.
It's when Rufus is taken away for the last time and he says he made suggestions to me and everyone's like, what? Shepherd's like, I never did. And he goes, he said he was an atheist. He said there was no God. And everyone's like, oh, okay. All right. That's fine then.
Mm-hmm.
But he's sitting there and it's funny because he keeps saying, I have nothing to reproach myself with.
Yeah. Yeah. Because he's lamenting this failure with Rufus Johnson.
Right.
And he's like telling himself, I've got nothing to reproach myself with. I did nothing wrong. And then he said,
I did more for him than I did for my own child. And he says it three times.
Three times, yeah.
And then that magic three. And then he hears what he's been saying. I did more for him than I did for my own child. And he realizes what he's done.
Mm-hmm.
This was so powerful. It says his mouth twisted and he closed his eyes against the revelation. Norton's face rose before him, empty, forlorn, his left eye listing almost imperceptibly toward the outer rim as if he could not bear a full view of grief. His heart constricted with repulsion for himself so clear and intense that he gasped for breath. He had stuffed his own emptiness with good works like a glutton. He had ignored his own child to feed his vision of himself. He saw the clear-eyed devil, the sounder of hearts, leering at him from the eyes of Johnson. His image of himself shriveled until everything was black before him. He sat there paralyzed, aghast.
Mm. Yeah.
And then his heart's full with love for his child.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to finish it?
Oh, boy.
You picked the story, man.
I did. Yeah, he saw Norton at the telescope, all back in ears, saw his arms shoot up and wave frantically. A rush of agonizing love for the child rushed over him like a transfusion of life. The little boy's face appeared to him transformed, the image of his salvation, all light. He groaned with joy. He would make everything up to him. He would never let him suffer again. He would be mother and father. He jumped up and ran to his room to kiss him, to tell him that he loved him, that he would never fail him again. The light was on in Norton's room, but the bed was empty. He turned and dashed up the attic stairs and at the top reeled back like a man on the edge of a pit. The tripod had fallen and the telescope lay on the floor. A few feet over it, the child hung in the jungle of shadows, just below the beam from which he had launched his flight into space.
Ugh, knife in my heart.
Oh, yeah. Tough. But wow. Yeah. So that's, again, yeah, it is perfect. And that's Shepherd's moment. I don't know how you go on from there, but he was that's his moment, like we were talking about in moments in the previous story.
Yeah.
And it took all that for him to see.
Mm-hmm.
Although the kid could have stayed alive and he could have gone up and hugged him and said, I'll never do that again. Mm-hmm. Been more cheerful. But no, you're right. It was perfect. And it's
well, no. But it was the natural conclusion of everything that had gone on. I mean, you're right. She could have softened the end.
Yeah.
And she did in the story I picked.
Excellent.
But she doesn't do that in many of the stories. Most of them, there's a real conclusion of, it's kind of like she won't cheat you.
Mm-hmm.
The characters in these stories have to, I don't want to say they have to pay for what they've done, but there is a real cost to our actions.
Right.
You know?
And there's a real moment of change.
Right.
They don't change without this moment. And it's a shame that that's somewhat true for a lot of people as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's these things, these jarring things that snap you out of the trance you're in or the habits you've gotten into.
Right.
And the hope is, you know, you read a story with a jarring moment and it makes you think about yourself and you're like, okay,
right.
You know, there's something I need to fix right here. You know, and certainly, you know, when you read that story and you have kids, you're like, wow, am I doing okay? I mean, it sure makes you feel, you know, think about, you know, all this stuff that I do is, you know, it makes you think about yourself, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
That is a wonderful thing.
Yeah. Well, and also just the fact that no one in this story is adequately prepared or, well, I can't find a good word, but they're not adequate to guide each other. And so poor Norton's bouncing back and forth between these two points of view, which are both ill-informed.
Yes. That's
a good
point,
too. And having
to
find his own path.
Yeah. I mean, he is left. He's got nothing. No anchor, no bedrock, nothing to stand on at all.
Mm-hmm.
He's making his own conclusions 100%.
Yeah, and you like to think that if the story had had a different ending, the father would have truly done what he said he would do.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't know.
You don't know.
Like to think so.
Right, right.
In this, you just have to look at it and go, he has hit his lowest possible point, and the only place to go from there is up. And you hear people telling their own personal stories, Christians especially, and they'll talk about how even though something was awful, it wasn't as bad as it could have been because something good came from it later they could not see. There was the genesis or the germ of something that grew into something better. And those are the moments that as Catholics or Christians, just in general, when somebody's going through something horrible, you can't make it better. You would like to make it better for them, but all you can do is pray and pray that God will show them good coming from it.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's a mistake that some people make when they come to religion in the first place, that they're somehow thwarting tragedy. you know, if I pray enough and everything, it's a common mistake that, you know, that's not how it works. You know, I think it helps you deal with tragedy and help you, you know, be comforted with, you know, hopeful things. But it's not going to fix tragedy.
Accidents happen. People die. Disease comes up. But what if you're hopefully grounded in some sort of a good relationship with Christ, what you can do is remember that he's gone through all that stuff before we did. Mm. I mean, that's the thing I love about reading the Gospels, I have to say, is I can't think of something where he didn't come across something or go through it himself also.
Mm, yeah.
He understands what we're feeling, and so do the saints who we can turn to ask pray for us. And sometimes that really gives you a sense of peace that you don't expect. And it doesn't mean that you're not going to suffer and it won't be hard and awful, but it's never the bottom. It's never hopeless.
Yeah, yeah.
And there can always be something good brought out of it. It's just, it's not going to be easy, but life isn't easy. No, we were never promised life would be easy and happy. No. As my mother-in-law said to me one time. Luckily, she was talking about somebody else. But she says, what that person needs to understand is we weren't promised life would be happy. And I, not a Christian, went, no one had ever said anything like that around me. Mm-hmm. And she was just old school Catholic, just kind of saying that, like, well, everybody knows this. And I went, huh. And that, I really thought about that for a long time. And that's kind of what these stories are all at the base of it, you know?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
She's extreme, obviously. Flannery O'Connor, but that's, I was like, yeah, we weren't promised a happy life. We act like we were promised a happy life.
Yes, yeah.
But of course, what Catholics and Christians, any Christians, should say mm-hmm. is, yeah, that's because inside we know how it should be, but this world is broken.
Right. Yeah, the gap between what we know should be and what is sin, right?
Yeah.
You know, in a person, you know, you know what your ideal is, at least you hope to, but there's always a gap.
Right.
Yep.
Yep.
So, yeah, let's get on to the next story. Revelation, because there's a little gap. Yeah.
I love Mrs. Turpin so much.
She made me laugh over and over. I love that we're finishing with this story because it's great.
I'm so glad I picked it after the other one that we talked about. I didn't pick it for that reason, but it's a real, actually fairly simple story. Mrs. Turpin and her husband Claude have gone to the doctor, and Claude got kicked by a cow, so he's got his leg has to be checked on. It's got an ulcer or something on it. Mm-hmm. And the thing about the doctor's office that's really great in this story is all humanity from this little town is crammed in there together. You've got the white trash, you have the pleasant people, you have the pleasant people's ugly, horrible daughters, you have old men. And so when Mrs. Turpin's trying to start a nice conversation with the pleasant woman, everybody starts joining in. And this is when you find out that Mrs. Turpin spends a lot of her time, talk about an internal monologue. She spends a lot of time. This is one of the stories that my book club read. And when we'd read it out loud is when I discovered how funny she could be. And it says, sometimes at night when she couldn't go to sleep, Mrs. Turpin would occupy herself with the question of who she would have chosen to be if she couldn't have been herself. If Jesus had said to her before he made her, there's only two places available for you. You can either be a nigger or white trash. What would she have said? Please, Jesus, please, she would have said, just let me wait until there's another place available. And he would have said, no, you have to go right now, and I only have those two places, so make up your mind. She would have wiggled and squirmed and begged and pleaded, but it would have been no use. And finally, she would have said, all right, make me a nigger then, but that doesn't mean a trashy, that don't mean a trashy one. And he would have made her a neat, clean, respectable Negro woman herself, but black. She's continually running this dialogue of, well, what would I have said if, you know, every time somebody talks to her who she doesn't like or who she thinks is odd or, you know, what would Jesus have said if, you know, it's like so awful. And
she's got a nice disposition.
Yeah, she's nice and pleasant.
I thank the Lord he has blessed me with a good one, Mrs. Turpin said.
She is pretty self-satisfied.
Yep.
She spends all her time internally judging everyone and putting them in these little slots, and none of them are as good as her slot. Mm-hmm. And but the whole time, the pleasant woman, whose name we never hear, her daughter, Mary Grace, and her name means something. Yeah. She keeps looking at Mrs. Turpin, and Mrs. Turpin doesn't like to look at her because not only is she ugly, which, of course, Mrs. Turpin's so glad she wasn't ugly, but wasn't born ugly. Mm-hmm. But she also gets this real uncomfortable feeling like her eyes are seeing exactly who she is. Her eyes are looking right through her. And so she's giving her a lot of weight that she's not giving to anyone else there. And eventually toward the end, she says out loud something like, Jesus, thank you, or something like that, right?
I've got it right here, yeah. If it's one thing I am, Mrs. Turpin said with feeling, it's grateful. When I think of who all I could have been besides myself and what all I got, a little of everything and a good disposition besides, I just feel like shouting, thank you, Jesus, for making everything the way it is. It could have been different.
And Mary Grace throws this huge book, Human Development.
The book struck her directly over her left eye. It struck almost the same instant she realized the girl was about to hurl it. I love it.
Oh, and then funny. She knocks her down, or she falls on the floor, and then doesn't Mary Grace try to choke her also?
Yeah. The girl's fingers sank like clamps into the soft flesh of her neck.
Yeah.
It's like,
and she says,
yeah.
Well, the thing that's really funny, though, is it says, Mrs. Turpin's head cleared and her power of motion returned. After everybody's been running around and holding Mary Claire, she leaned forward until she was looking directly into the fierce, brilliant eyes. There was no doubt in her mind that the girl did know her in some intense and personal way beyond time and place and condition. What you got to say to me? She asked hoarsely and held her breath, waiting as for a revelation. The girl raised her head, her gaze locked with Mrs. Turpin's. Go back to hell where you came from, you old warthog, she whispered. Her voice was low but clear. Her eyes burned for a moment as if she saw with pleasure that her message had struck its target.
Hmm. Yep.
And that message, go back to hell where you came from, you old warthog, sticks in Mrs. Turpin's mind.
Mm-hmm.
She can't shake it. They go home. The doctor fixes her up, says, just go home and rest. She and Claude go home, and they lie down. But then eventually they have to do chores, and they have pigs. One of the things they were pleasantly chatting about was taking care of the pigs in their cement parlor. And there's some black people, you know, of course, niggers, as she calls them, who help pick cotton. So Claude's got to go pick them up and take them back where they live. And, you know, she kind of tells her sad story about getting attacked. And then she's like, why do I even tell them? That you can't believe a thing they say when they're saying, oh, that's terrible. That's awful. I can't believe that. You know,
she says something about that, you know, they'll compliment her all day long, but it doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you could talk to them, but not with them or something like that.
Yeah, it was terrible. Yep.
Yeah, it was really, was like, and actually, though, it was probably accurate because she was accurately judging the fact that they're having to respond in a social form.
Yeah, that's to a superior, they can't say, right?
They have to say something.
Yeah.
They can't say what they're really thinking. Mm-hmm. And we don't know what that is, but it probably isn't great. They're out picking their cotton and she feels like she's a saint for bringing them a bucket of ice water when they come in from the field.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they know how to judge her, I'm sure. So
yeah.
What are they going to do? But she needs something. And so she's lying in bed thinking about it. She's thinking about it when she's taking care of the pigs. And so then she starts talking to God. She's, what do you send me a message like that for? She said in a low, fierce voice, barely above a whisper, but with the force of a shout in its concentrated fury. How am I a hog and me both? How am I saved and from hell too? And she goes on yelling and yelling. Mm-hmm. And it says, in the deepening light, everything was taking on a mysterious hue. The pasture was growing a peculiar glassy green, and the streak of highway had turned lavender. She braced herself for a final assault. And this time her voice rolled out over the pasture. Go on, she yelled. Call me a hog. Call me a hog again from hell. Call me a warthog from hell. Put that bottom rail on top. There'll still be a top and a bottom. Who do you think, you know, it says, and it says a final surge of fury shook her and she roared, who do you think you are? And then she has an honest to goodness vision.
Mm-hmm.
And the revelation is, it's everybody going into heaven. The white trash are there. They're all cleaned up. The black people are all there. They're all happy and cleaned up and everything. Mm-hmm. And behind, at the very back, and the battalions of freaks and lunatics, I guess that's like Mary Claire, leaping like frogs. And then at the very end was a tribe of people whom she recognized at once as one of those who, like herself and Claude, had always had a little of everything and the God-given wit to use it right. They're going with great dignity, doing everything just the way they should. They alone were on key. Yet she could see by their shocked and altered faces that their virtues were being burned away. And that just shuts her down.
Right. Hmm. Yep.
So she's seen the true picture of, here's the divine slotting of how it works.
Yes.
She's been labeling everyone. You want to know how I see it?
Well, that's what God says, right? Jesus? Yeah. You know, the whole...
the last shall come first?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and the prodigal son, you know, the... Yeah. The one who leaves right? for a while, goes and spends all his money and parties till he's broken and comes home and he's celebrated. But the one that was there the whole time.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and actually, when that story is really good to think about with this, because that story Jesus tells to the Pharisees. He's answering the Pharisees complaining to him, and he tells three different parables and that. So the story is not about the prodigal son. The story is about the elder son and his attitude.
Right, right.
So that's, well, Flannery O'Connor said in one of her letters about this story, she said, "You got to be a very big woman to shout at the Lord across a hog pen. She's a country female Jacob, and that vision is purgatorial."
Wow.
But I could see how she could love her characters, because Mrs. Turpin is awful, but I love her.
Oh, yeah. She's something.
I think it's because she lets what that person says get to her. She worries about it. She thinks about it. She doesn't let it go.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you just let it go, then yeah. Yeah, that would be different, wouldn't it? But yeah, I know people like her. I really do. You know, it's like, yeah, there's something else.
Well, and how often, you know, this is the thing where you talk about these stories reflecting back into your life, and you know, you try not to do that.
Absolutely.
I try to be proper like Mrs. Turpin and sing on key. but that's, I guess that's in a sense, really, that's the story of the way she would think about other people is like the Pharisees standing in the temple going, "Thank you, God, that you made me wonderful and not like this guy over here." And that guy, whoever he was, I can't remember, the sinner, we know that. Was going, "I'm so sorry for everything, you know, forgive me."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Mrs. Turpin is the Pharisee.
Yeah, yeah. That's fantastic. I love it. I love it.
Yeah. It's one of the last stories she wrote. Well, it's the last story she got published before she died, I think. Yeah,
and this collection actually came out after she died. They weren't collected into a book until after.
Yeah, she'd said she wanted to do some more work on them, but she said, "But I'm sick and I won't get out of here. Who knows when I'll get out of here, so go ahead and take them the way they are."
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, wow, what would you have done?
So she died, for those who don't know, complications from lupus.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, August 3rd, 1964.
Yeah, yep. Her father had died from lupus. And then when they discovered she had it, she had to go back home and live. She'd been, you know, out on her own writing. Not for very long, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I remember. Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. There was just one other thing I just realized that we haven't even talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the grotesque. You know, it's like, you know, Rufus had a club foot and the kid, even in the first line of that previous story, you know, he had an eye that was looking off sideways, just barely.
Yeah.
But there's this quote regarding...
Mary Grace has horrible acne.
Yeah. So regarding her emphasis on the grotesque, Flannery O'Connor says, "Anything that comes out of the South is going to be called grotesque by the Northern reader, unless it is grotesque, in which case it's going to be called realistic."
That makes me laugh. Clear vision. I mean, it's just a way of zinging things where... It's just, she was so right, you know.
There's this other quote in this article. "The stories are hard, but they are hard because there is nothing harder or less sentimental than Christian realism. When I see these stories described as horror stories, I am always amused because the reviewer always has hold of the wrong horror."
Hmm.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, I guess maybe that's why I could say that the ending of The Lame Shall Enter First was perfect. And I don't mean to pat myself on the back in terms of saying I probably have the whole wrong hold of the wrong end of a lot of these things. But you could just see that's where the story had to go to make that point stick with that father.
Yeah.
He's going to be patting himself on the back pretty soon. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, we don't need to be patting ourselves on the back, right? I mean, there's always more work to do.
Well, and that's the thing. It's that fine line of not putting yourself down for no reason, but being realistic. You know, the definition of humble is you know where you stand in relation to God, and that God gave you all these things. So some things that you do are good. That's good.
Mm-hmm.
Probably not because, you know, you're building on something you were given that you have no credit for. That's okay.
Right, right.
And the things you do bad, you try to fix. But you don't, it's not the lie down and be a floor mat thing.
Right, right.
And yep, that's agreed. Stories are about that.
Yeah, they sure are.
Man. Well, I don't know if this enlightened anyone else. Boy, Scott, I'm really glad you picked these.
Well, thank you very much. I had a great time.
Yeah.
Yep.
Now we can stop crying and weeping gently to ourselves.
I can rejoin my family.
Oh, no, wait. Yeah. I picked Calvary for a movie, we'll be back soon. Right.
Hey, fantastic. Fantastic. I look forward to that. Yeah. Well, wonderful. Well, I guess that's everything, right? We've been talking for about an hour and a half almost.
Oh no. Really sorry, everyone.
No, hopefully they enjoy it. Yeah, and we only did three stories. At the beginning we thought we might do four.
Oh, thank goodness we didn't.
Yeah, right. It's just a lot. There's so much there. We could probably do another podcast on the rest of them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But don't worry. But we won't.
No, please tell me we won't. Okay,
we won't.
Give All it right. another year or two.
So what's coming up next?
The big announcement.
I think you should let her rip.
Me?
Yeah.
Oh, well, it's going to be episode 100.
100.
And our special mystery guest is Brother Guy Consolmagno. Is that who you say it?
Consolmagno, yeah.
Consolmagno. Okay.
That's right.
And he is the Vatican astronomer, mm-hmm. written a lot of books. Well, now the Vatican has more than one astronomer.
Yes, indeed.
But he's the one who I know best.
Yeah, because he's written books.
Right.
Yeah. Brother Astronomer was one. The latest mm-hmm. one is Would You Baptize an Extraterrestrial? Which he wrote with Father Paul Muller, and is written kind of in his dialogue format, and it just works beautifully. What a good book it is. It's wonderful.
It is brilliant. Yeah. It is brilliant. And I guess when we do this, I'll put a link to, I have a written review of it.
Excellent. Yeah.
And so we told him he could choose any book or movie he wanted, and he chose Among Others by Joe Walton, because he is a personal friend of hers, and also he had some very interesting insights about the book. So.
Yes, he did. So that'll be our next episode, 100. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine? 100.
No.
I love it.
I guess I have to because it happened. But
all right, so that'll be out. That'll be out in 2 weeks, mm-hmm. and then 2 weeks after that, we've got a movie that you mentioned.
Yeah,
that'll bring us right down again into the
way down
into Flannery O'Connor territory, Calvary.
Right?
Calvary. Literally looking forward to that movie.
Oh, yeah.
And then
it's gonna be super.
I really
am. Oh no, if you pick Flannery O'Connor, you're gonna love this movie.
Okay, good. All right, and then after that you picked a book.
Yes, I was really noticing the downward dark trend, so I went for something that was a little bit easier and lighter, and I kind of think of it in terms of being a book more like The Rosie Project or something
that. Yeah,
Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore.
Right. Hey, I noticed that you're reading book two of Rosie.
I am.
How's it going?
I'm trying to just let it flow over me because it can't be as brilliant and surprising as the first one.
Mm-hmm.
But it's looking at, you know, their first year of marriage together.
Okay.
And Rosie's going to have a baby, and how's that going to be? And so I'm kind of trying to think of it in so it's not obviously grabbing me since I'm trying to think of it in terms of, well, marriage changes you, so how is this working in the book?
Right. Okay. But, yeah. Let me know how it is.
I will.
That's good. And then I picked an 8-episode BBC series. So it's only 8 hours long, everyone.
Going again for the length.
Again for the length and the depth.
Yeah, death. That's what you're going for.
Exactly.
Death.
It's called Broadchurch. Terrific. I really love it.
Yeah.
So I can't wait to talk about it. Yes. I don't think I'd have picked it unless I'd give you an even more time. But that's like, what, 2, 4, 6, 8 weeks away. So people have lots of time to watch it. It's on Netflix.
It's streaming.
Called Broadchurch.
Yeah.
And then I'm up to pick another book, so I've got to get that done.
Well, we have some time.
Book selection coming. Yeah.
Okay.
TBD.
Yeah. 1,200 pages. I can't wait.
You know, why don't we read a trilogy?
Oh, perfect. I have a month and nothing to do.
Oh, perfect.
War and Peace.
Yes. I love it. All right. Well, thanks, everybody. Thanks for coming.
Yes.
Thanks for listening.
And
we'll see you in a couple of weeks with Brother Guy.
Bye-bye. Bye.